If you're landing here for the first time, this is the final episode of Expanse Season 1, Pink Diamond Heist. Best to go back and start this story at Episode 1.
This is an ABC podcast.
I have this mate, Tyrone, who had a stint working in real estate in Connemara in the Kimberley. I've known Tyrone since our uni days, and he told me this story when I went up there for his wedding in 2008. He tells a great yarn about one of his tenants that was renting a place in Wyndham, the most northerly town in Western Australia. She was looking about in the roof. There, hidden in the rafters, was a diamond. She didn't know who put it there, but she assumed it was probably stolen from the Argyle diamond mine a couple of hours down the road. She actually worked at Argyle and told Tyrone she returned her mystery jewel to the mine. The previous tenant of this house also worked at Argyle. Tyrone says Argyle used to rent out loads of houses in local towns for its workers.
There were rumours around that diamonds were being found in Antwerp or India, and that might have been so, because it was pretty easy to walk onto that mine. There were so many diamonds that you could actually hand pan it.
Argyle boss Mick O'Leary said our pink diamond heist was a turning point at the mine.
But that really, the first time we knew that this was being done almost professionally.
So where did these heist diamonds end up? This episode, we're going to find out where the jewels are now. I'm going to get my hands on some of these diamonds quite literally, and I'll meet people still discovering the lost loot. I'm Sinead Mangan, and we've arrived at our final episode, Pink Diamond Heist, Episode 5, Rodden's Diamonds. I was not one of those girls who lusted after diamonds. Unlike Marilyn Monroe, I didn't think diamonds were a girl's best friend. Cynical me found the whole concept of a diamond engagement ring clever marketing that sucked in generations of lovers, keen to show off a symbol of their ownership. And then, early on in my career, I had a gig reporting on diamond explorers. Their lust for diamonds was bordering on a bit mad. They'd spend millions looking for what was the ultimate needle in a haystack. But then I came to appreciate what went into making a diamond. The sheer force of the Earth's energy required to produce that bit of sparkle, because every natural diamond was created billions of years ago deep in the Earth's crust. A volcanic explosion eventually thrusting the gems to the surface. As jewellery historian Vivian Becker says, man's desire for diamonds is nothing new.
People, you know, lied and killed and traded their whole empires on them. But as I say, pink diamonds were found only sporadically. You know, they're a sort of random fluke of nature. And so they were even more prized because of that combination of the colour and the brilliance, until, of course, the Argyle mine was discovered in the 1970s.
So when Argyle began mining an Aladdin's cave of diamonds, including the unusual pinks, it was little wonder thieves started to sniff around. Our crooks conspired to steal diamonds in an elaborate international heist that went on for several years. But like all great stories, it was greed, lust and anger that finally gave them away. Lindsay Rodden and Barry and Lynette Crimmins were done for stealing diamonds. But how they did the time was startlingly different. The judge sentenced Rodden to 6 years, but gave him a discount of 3 years for time clocked up in custody and home detention. He was also eligible for parole in 12 months. Newspapers at the time reported how controversial this relatively light sentencing was, with politicians calling for an appeal. Barry told my producer Sarah that he didn't do any jail time. It was one of the first things he mentioned to her without even being asked. So we looked into it. The courts confirmed he was sentenced on the 16th of February 1994 to 4 years imprisonment. Parole was ordered, so it's possible Barry spent his prison time in the community. Then Lynette was put in witness protection, and we heard in episode 3 how that turned out. She was allegedly sexually assaulted by the police minder she had that day. The Argyle diamond heist also left its imprint on the investigators in the case.
I'd already had a death threat.
That's Argyle Chief Investigator Richard Corfield.
It was relayed to me, okay, watch yourself, and which of course I did.
So that must have been pretty frightening then.
Oh, yes.
For your family as well, not just for you, because you had your daughter as well.
My daughter was uni at the time, and they had a watch on her because the uni she'd chosen was Darwin, because as far as she could get away, she could get from us without needing a passport.
And the ripple effects are still felt by the first police officer to investigate the Argyle case, Robin Thoy. He was the one that had a price on his head.
My daughter is still a little bit damaged by it. My wife is too. But really, what can you do? If I'd gone to the bosses, what would happen to me? There'd be a white coat standing outside my door with a stretcher. I didn't want that.
And is that why you chose as a family to move to somewhere quite remote that people couldn't find you?
Yeah, I didn't want to deal with people anymore.
That's the human story. Now, let's get back to the other major player in this story. The diamonds. These diamonds have had quite the journey, from being picked up off the processing floor on a mine site, shoved into Barry Crimmins' pockets, stashed in some shampoo bottles, and snuck out in his carry-alls on a flight back to Perth.
From out of the vault comes a collection of precious diamonds, revealed only in Argyle's final year of production. These diamonds hold the secrets of a colourful chapter in Argyle's history and bring to light a riveting account of temptation and desire.
So what became of these stolen diamonds? Well, for starters, we know that Perth jeweller Rowan Milne was bidding on some of them. We're going to catch up with him. Remember, last time he was weighing up how much to bid for the stones. So what were the diamonds in this intrigue package like?
It's a pretty small group of people in the world that actually get to bid on these things. And I was like, come on, like, you know, just put me out of my misery.
Yeah.
Like, you know, do I have to find the money or don't I have to find the money? And generally, they only give you 5 working days to pay. So I got a phone call and I was actually driving next to Lake Munger. I was actually going to see a client to drop off a ring. And I just started laughing. I thought it was, what have I done? You've bought a box of diamonds that was stolen that you've not even picked up and looked at. You've just seen pictures of with a fancy story or a funny story that goes with it. But I never buy stones that I don't actually pick up and loop, you know. So I'd kind of taken a bit of a punt here.
Usually when Rowan successfully wins an Argyle auction, he can fit the parcel of diamonds in his pocket. Not this time.
And normally if you win a tender stone, you know, it's one reasonably small stone in a parcel, whereas this was like a box of lots of different shaped stones. It was like Christmas. It was like, oh my God, look at this, look at this. And because it was the first time I'd seen it. So it was really exciting.
Little did I know I was about to clap eyes on them. I was about to actually handle the diamonds I'd been obsessing about.
And where are they now?
Well, I've got a few on the table here.
Have he?
Yeah.
Give us a look.
Spoiler alert, much to my surprise, the diamonds were not pink.
Oh, wow. Is that not pure white?
That is pure white.
Yeah.
Which is unusual.
For Argyle.
Yeah.
Can I hold it?
Yeah, go for it.
Wow. They were cut by Argyle as well?
These were cut by Argyle, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so these would have been just rough, essentially looking like bits of dirty pebbles with a bit of a glistening glint to the edge of it. Because they were the stolen ones, they were pre-acid, so they would have been quite dirty. So it's amazing to think that they'd just been sitting in the back of Argyle's safe for, what, 30-odd years?
Uncut or cut?
Uncut.
Uncut.
Yeah.
At what stage did they get cut?
Well, I'm assuming it was last year.
Right.
They haven't even divulged to me when exactly they cut them.
Rowan was successful in bidding for the package of 20 diamonds that make up the Argyle intrigue. They're an array of colours, from brilliant white to champagne, but not a pink amongst them. A receipt I've seen proves Lindsay Rodden sent stolen pink diamonds straight to Europe.
He sent pinks directly overseas because they were the most valuable. That means the pinks are still out there somewhere. We're going to meet a scientist who thinks some of these pinks have come across his desk. But first to Rio Tinto to find out how diamonds nicked 30 years ago end up back in its possession. So what have these diamonds been up to other than gathering dust in its vault? I met with Michelle Shearing, who's responsible for sales and marketing of exclusive diamonds at Argyle. Her global travelling companions are some of the priciest diamonds in the world. She's also a diamond technical expert.
So it was a long time between the recovery, which was, or the warrants being issued, which was understood to be in the early 90s, and them eventually landing back in the Argyle offices.
It was almost a decade.
So approximately 50 carats of diamonds were recovered in that initial process and returned to the Argyle diamond polishing facility around 2010. When they did arrive back with us, they were in rough form. Some of them had been part processed. And by that I mean cleaved, so cut in half, with the planning for the polishing already underway.
So the intention would have been to sell them in some sort of polished form. Is that what your thinking was?
Okay, well, certainly with the way that they had been cleaved or sawn would have suggested that they were working towards an ultimate polished outcome as when they were retrieved by the warrants.
So Lindsay Rodden never got to finish the job of polishing the diamonds. Before they're repossessed by police and returned to Argyle, they are passed between Lynette Crimmins to Rodden on the black market, where someone took a saw to the jewels. And as a diamond expert, did they wreck them in any way?
No, I don't think so. I mean, the ultimate outcomes were beautiful.
Before they became Rowan's diamonds, Rio Tinto called them Rodden's diamonds.
Certainly known as the Rodden diamonds. They were identified as part of that investigation and the process, and we did coin them forever and, I guess, internally always referred to them as the Rodden diamonds.
They were kept in the back of Rio Tinto's vault.
You know, if you see it, you know, on a shelf, you would not think that this box contains diamonds. It's a wooden box. Within them is 20 parcels, very small parcels, which the diamonds are contained in, each labelled uniquely. But following the polishing process, they were, I guess, certified. They were placed in diamond parcel papers or briefcases in the back of the safe, and really, held there for a number of years. We always knew that these diamonds, were lingering about at the back of this large safe, and at times we would actually pull them out and sit and contrast and compare them against our pinks, because to have that beautiful contrast of colours of the whites and champagnes against pink, it's really beautiful and actually something even quite unusual for our team.
Diamonds are most commonly white, but these ones were unusually pure in colour.
We often, we would have the benefit of playing with beautiful pinks, but to have these really intriguing, alluring white diamonds in the safe was always quite a novelty.
Police held onto the jewels for a number of years before returning them to Argyle. During this time, police brought forensic scientist John Watling in on the case. He's an analytical chemist. He does sort of detective work on substances to figure out where they come from.
And then I take the compositional data and do a lot of statistics and messing around with it to be able to, categorise the data and associate it with a specific material. So, for example, if I'm looking at, in a studio where we are now, if I'm looking at two chairs, were they made in the same batch in the factory? And we're able to, for example, and this will, I think, resonate, take a pork chop from a supermarket and tell you which farm it came from. So it's that specific.
It blows my mind that today's science can get down to that level of detail. But the research has been in the works for a long time, and Professor John Watling is the pioneer of this inorganic forensic fingerprinting.
The original start of this was a technique called gold fingerprinting.
This ability to trace gold back to the source came in handy when John Watling moved to Perth in the 80s. He was called in by police to help crack lots of gold theft cases.
It was the Wild West in those days, and stealing gold from the mines wasn't uncommon. But at that stage, he'd no experience tracing diamonds.
We were interested in trying to provenance the diamonds to start with, trying to say these are Argyle stones. That was the first thing we did. And then it fortuitously happened that the case of theft from Argyle came about, and we were involved in that case quite obviously from the start. So we were looking then at, that case involved us only in white diamonds in clear stones. It didn't involve us in any coloureds.
Our heist trio were a bit clever and sent the more valuable coloured diamonds to Europe.
So all of the stones I looked at for that case were recovered stones from the people that were involved in stealing them. I was told that they were associated with the Roddan theft.
The police didn't find any pink stones.
The question was a very simple one. Did these come from Argyle or from the Argyle mine? That was a very simple case. And those stones were, they were beautiful stones. Some of them were 3, 4 carat, 5 carat and more. And it was simply a matter of, okay, here they are. Go and do your thing, whatever that is, as far as they were concerned, and tell us whether or not they came from the Argyle mine. And that's what I did with them.
Of the 50-odd diamonds he tested, he could categorically prove that all but 2 were from Argyle. The science has got so sophisticated, now it can trace a diamond back to the very pipe it was originally formed in, almost a billion years ago. Professor Watling focuses a laser beam on the surface of the diamond. The focal point becomes so hot, it boils. Then the evaporated diamond material can be measured and forensically tested to compare it to the other previously catalogued diamonds. This is microscopic what we're talking about here. This technique has made it much harder to get away with stealing diamonds.
It says to people, you thought you could get away with it, but you actually can't. So they fess up in a lot of cases, and we don't go to court.
The crimins fessed up. Lindsay Roddan claimed innocence, but eventually they were all done for the crime. But will we ever know how many diamonds our thieving ring managed to get their mitts on? We know our trio stole a lot more than what Rowan Milne has just bought from Argyle. Robin Ellison from Rio Tinto confirms this.
The diamonds that were recovered weren't, we don't think, were everything that was stolen. They were what we were able to recover from search warrants. So my understanding is that there were other, you know, potentially there were pinks, for example, that were stolen that were never found.
Mick O'Leary was the most senior person in the hierarchy of the Argyle mine when our heist happened. He said it's impossible to pinpoint how many diamonds were stolen.
The only way they could have determined it is if they had volunteered the ones who were stealing them. But I'd never heard of them coming clean on how much they took.
Pink diamonds like the ones from our heist are worth more now because the mine's recently shut. There's less of them, so they're more valuable. That's why it matters how many diamonds our thieves got away with. These tiny stones are an easy way to move currency around undetected, which is why Lynette, Lindsay and Barry got away with the crime for so long.
I mean, in a way, it's got that edge. It gives it that edge of danger, if you like. Just adds a little bit more spice to the story. And of course, the diamond is the ultimate in portable wealth, in stealth wealth.
Jewellery historian Vivian Becker chatted to me from her kitchen in London. It's clear she's never lost her delight in the diamond industry.
The incredible stories of people escaping from, for instance, Russia during the revolution, you know, with diamonds sewn into their clothes, fleeing across borders. Diamonds have started new lives for people in Paris or America. I guess that goes hand in hand, the intense value. And it's a universal currency. So, yeah, it's just part of the history.
One of the most famous pink diamonds of all was unearthed by Christie's auction house in Geneva, Switzerland. Christie's jewellery expert Max Fawcett was there the day it was discovered.
In 2017, we were called to a European family office, someone that we've never done business with before. They claimed to have an important diamond that had belonged to the family for 100 years. So we went to a very nondescript family office, nothing special, nothing I thought we were on a wild goose chase as such. And they opened up this old piece of parcel paper, and in there was a pink diamond. Big, big pink diamond, 19.07 carats was the weight. And they said, this is a royal pink diamond. Of course, we did some history, and it turned out that it was the Grand Mazarin, which had passed through the hands of five kings, Louis XIV, the Sun King, two emperors, it belonged to Napoleon I. And then it came up in the sale of the French crown jewels in the late 19th century and was bought by Frederick Boucheron, and then stayed from then sold into this family and stayed there ever since. And, you know, to see something like that with so much, you know, French royal history, over 200 years of French royal history, we took that for auction and we sold it for just under 14 and a half million francs at the time. So that was incredibly exciting.
It makes you wonder, remember that huge, deep pink diamond talked about earlier that Lynette and Lindsay Rodden argued about in court? The one concealed in the all-day pink starlet lipstick. Imagine if it's discovered years from now in an important jewellery collection. There's a common thread between the French crown jewel story and our yarn. Throughout history, diamonds continue to turn up in the most peculiar of places, including my hometown of Perth. We're about to meet someone who suspects he's come across more of Rodden's loot.
My lab have got techniques using, for example, two different lasers and looking for particular emissions from the stones that pretty well uniquely identify them as being argyle.
Physicist John Chapman started to work for Argyle in the 80s. He was working in the mining headquarters when our diamond heist happened, and like myself, has been obsessed with the story ever since.
Anything that involves skullduggery and a bit of crime is quite a spicy thing to have in the workplace.
The other John, Professor John Watling, we heard from earlier, was working on his fingerprinting technology in the academic sector at the same time that this John, John Chapman, was working at Argyle's office using lasers to better understand the unique properties of its diamonds.
The first PhD student I got working on this in Melbourne, I sent him 10 pink diamonds of probably over a carat each. But in more recent years, there's no way they'd let one of them out of their sight. So I just sort of put them in the mail, posted off to him, and he probably had them kicking around in his drawer. But yes, nowadays they'd be worth several million dollars.
As pink diamonds become more valuable, people are keen to find out what theirs are worth. John's busy riding this wave of interest and recently set up a small lab in Perth to test diamonds for punters.
There were a lot of diamonds out there which hadn't received an Argyle certificate.
John tells a great story of a man who walked into a pawn shop and bought a diamond a few years ago. It was pink, and just recently he sent it to John to get tested.
I had one person the other day who bought one from a cash converter or some such place.
And how much was it worth? Were they pleased with the result?
Oh, very much so, particularly when I heard how much they paid for it. But yes, that particular one, you have to see what the prices of pinks are doing there. Quite eye-watering, but I think that one was worth about $50,000 and he'd only paid seven or something.
Argyle began mining diamonds in the Kimberley in 1985.
So in 40 years, we mined a lot of pink diamonds.
That's Sinead Kaufman. She's the chief executive of Rio Tinto Minerals. She has a big job. Not only is she the boss of Argyle, but also the Diavik diamond mine in Canada, south of the Arctic Circle. So, naturally enough, she's a vested interest in how diamonds are being bought and sold in the future. It's the rare pinks that she's really focused on.
And we're very keen to continue to see them trade in the market, really keen to remain in the market despite the fact that the mine is closed.
Rio Tinto is trying to wrestle back control of the trade of pinks by setting up a trading platform. When Barry Crimmins made a habit of slipping the diamonds out of the mine to pass on to Lindsay Rodden, Argyle lost control of an unknown quantity of diamonds. There's a lot of pink diamonds out there that have never been certified, including the missing diamonds from our heist.
Going forward, the certification and the provenance of pink diamonds is really important.
provenance wasn't as big a deal back when our diamond trio pulled off their heist. When Argyle started mining, it only certified and inscribed the bigger stones that were over half a carat. John Chapman still comes across some mysterious diamonds in his small lab in Perth.
Yes, there are on occasions quite a nice diamond, a pink diamond, that comes through the lab. And you think, well, why has it not been either laser engraved with the Argyle? They put a number on it if it's above a certain size. But some of them you think, well, yes, it should be somewhere of being in the records of this. It might be 1 carat or something, and quite a strong pink.
He suspects these are some of our stolen gems.
Is it one of the diamonds, pink diamonds, that are believed to have, one of the many which are believed to have been taken from the mine under peculiar circumstances and found its way to the market?
All these years later.
All these years later, indeed.
When I spoke to John Chapman, his lab was only 6 months young, but he'd already handled a couple of stones he suspects were part of the heist. As I'm wrapping this up, he emailed to say he's seen more. It's more than 30 years since our crime was committed. Rio Tinto has shuttered the mine in the outback of Western Australia. And that's the end of the world's biggest source of pink diamonds. To mark this occasion, staff that used to work there wanted to have a party. And they put out a blanket invitation for a big fancy shindig in Perth. When we tracked down Barry, he mentioned casually that he'd gone to the staff reunion. This was just a month after the event. It struck me it would take some serious swagger to rock up. So we started to do some fact-checking and found he had the audacity to put it out on Facebook that he wanted to go. I canvassed some former colleagues that were there, including the former big boss, Mick O'Leary.
I didn't see him and I didn't hear anyone. Was he?
Apparently so.
God. Yeah.
The organisers checked the guest list for me and there wasn't a Crimmins on it. But I did find out Barry Crimmins fronted up at another event a few years ago. The former colleagues I spoke to considered it fine for him to be there, because in their words, he'd done his time. Let's return one last time to the scene of the crime. Back to that dusty red earth of the Kimberley where this whole story started. It just happens that Barry Crimmins was in Kununurra when he was charged by police for his part in the heist, even though at the time he lived thousands of kilometres away in Victoria and no longer worked at the mine. Barry told the court his ex-wife Lynette called him at the start of 1993 to say she'd confessed her role in the heist to police. But here's where it gets weird, I think. Barry told the court it was many months later, when he was on holiday in North Queensland, that he decided to follow Lynette's lead. He called police in Perth to arrange a meeting in Kununurra to dob himself in. Quick geography lesson. Kununurra in the Kimberley is a 30-hour drive from the east coast of northern Queensland. It's also quite a trip for Perth police, more than 3,000 kilometres. Why would Barry travel so far to the actual scene of the crime just in order to confess? There's a theory that Barry Crimmins had a stash of stolen Argyle diamonds somewhere in the bush. We've tried to put this allegation to him, but he's not picking up our calls anymore. When we went over timelines and court documents with a fine-tooth comb, it raised even more questions, because there are contradictions there. The Crimmins and their partner in crime, Lindsay Rodden, were still passing gems around long after Barry told the court he stopped stealing diamonds. If the rumour of the stash in the bush is true, and it's only a rumour, then I wonder if there's any of the Argyle diamonds left out bush. Whenever I talk to anyone about this story, they want to know just how much the thieves got away with. And when I started out, it was hard to know. Now, a year later, and after this podcast started to go to air, intel I've received and photos I've seen would suggest the loot wasn't 50 million, it was closer to 200 million. And that was back in the day. And if that's true, that would put the pink diamond heist as not only Australia's biggest heist, but one of the most valuable jewel heists
in the world. If you've enjoyed listening to the podcast, let your friends know about it. This podcast is hosted, researched and reported by me, Sinead Mangan. Sarah Allaly is the producer. Sound design and engineering by Adrian Sardi. And our executive producer is Edwina Farley. The podcast was recorded on the lands of the Whadjuk Noongar people. You can follow Pink Diamond Heist on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.
Hi, journalist Matthew Condon. If you're looking for another great ABC podcast to wrap your ears around, try the podcast I host. It's called Sirens Are Coming. In this season of Dig, I'm bringing you never-before-heard tape of the Sunshine State's most crooked cops and the courageous sex workers who dared to take them on.
You know, the next thing I turned around and he was there, Glenn O'Rourke. He said to me, "You don't seem yourself today. Are you not well?" I said, as a matter of fact, "I haven't been well all night. I said, I've had a bad headache." Mm. And I was a bit stuttery, and I do get a bit stuttery when I, you know, when I get nervous. So he not asked me that once, he asked me that twice. He said, "I think I should drive you home today." And I said, no, not at all.
Dorothy handed Hallahan the money. And when he walked off, the undercovers swooped.
But I wanted to turn around. I wanted to see what was going on with him. It was chaos. I'd given my right arm to know what was said. Mm. And the look on his face would have been amazing, wouldn't it?
Sirens Are Coming. You can hear it on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.